So thank you for joining Marianne Gebauer podcast. And this afternoon, I am delighted to be joined by Joel and Margaret Sussman from Aurora, Ontario. Joel and Margaret, thank you for taking the time to chat with me today.
Thanks for this opportunity.
So Joel and Margaret, you have made yourself rather famous in Canada for a September 2023 presentation that you gave the council in Aurora over a seemingly, what appears to be a takeover of the Aurora City Council by the UN. Would you like to explain the backdrop to this meeting and how this came to be?
Well, we had been watching a lot of presentations from other people. As I say, we stand on the shoulders of giants because the information and the education that we had received was gleaned from others who had done videos and written a lot of information about 15-minute cities. And that's how we became apprised of what was really going on.
Yeah, we did the research from multiple sources. And as Margaret said, there are some amazing pioneers in this area who have gone before us. We spoke with them, sometimes meeting in person when the opportunity afforded it, got a lot of great wisdom, watched a lot of videos, read a lot of material, and wove it into a fabric that formed the backbone of our conversation with council that evening.
Well, you very methodically talked about the takeover of Aurora, starting, it seemed, in 1992 was the most obvious event with Prime Minister Mulroney. Do you want to talk about what happened in 1992 that was significant?
Well, he signed us on to the UN, although I think actually previous to this, there had been a lot of talks, but that's when he actually signed us on to the UN. And 178 countries actually signed on by this time. So it was a real huge takeover.
Yeah, the formal thing he signed us on to was called UN Agenda 21, sort of a plan or agenda for the 21st century. When it was born back in the 80s and early 90s, 92 was when he actually signed the document. Then, of course, it was still the 20th century, so it was like future looking. And Agenda 21 has become, over time, as we pass the 2000 mark on the calendar, has become Agenda 2030. But they're both one and the same, just sort of a more grown-up, advanced version.
Right. So essentially, at that point in time, Canada became a UN member nation.
That's right.
That's right.
And what do you think motivated countries to sign on? Because this was not a mandatory. What do you think happened here?
Well, it was under the guise of turning us all into green nations. And of course, a lot of money was at the end of this rainbow. People, I think, didn't really understand what was going on at all, but money is always a huge incentive.
Yes, and then there was another key event in 1994 with what was called the municipal primer. And you talked about that in your presentation, outlining how all local towns or municipalities could restructure their governments. And again, this was non-binding, but all towns adopted it. Do you want to talk about the municipal primer and the importance of it?
Sure, the municipal primer. And again, we're going to refer in this conversation, Marianne, to a couple of places where people can source this information and actually look at it, print it if they want, or just download or read it on their screen. But the municipal primer was a document that was born from the UN and handed down. There's an organization that we came to know, it's called ICLEI, which stands for the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives. And it basically is the international arm of the UN reaching down into Canada to the past the federal, past the provincial, into the municipal ground level, cities, towns, villages, whatever, wherever there's a mayor and a council, and said, this is the way you're going to do things. And rather than question it at the time, it appears that everyone pretty well did a blanket sign on. maybe there was pressure or whatever, but it basically what it means is that the people behind ICLEI were instituting orders from, as you mentioned, a foreign, outside Canada, NGO, non-governmental organization, such as the UN, and the lovely people at the World Economic Forum and the World Health Organization are lurking in that quadrant as well. And it basically says, here is how you're going to do things. And as Margaret mentioned a minute ago, there was a lot of money behind it. And it says in our talk, basically, they were lured by the promise, to go green. So behind that was a ton of cash. It wasn't just what do you think is a good idea? Would you please do this for us? It was, no, here's the payoff, follow these instructions.
So in essence, the result is you have these foreign municipalities being controlled by foreign non-governmental organizations like the UN, the WHO, and G7, G20, the Council of Foreign Relations, and the World, and WEF, all right. Of these foreign-based NGOs, and all members are unelected, and essentially they are controlling our municipalities. Is that right? Do I understand this correctly?
Yes, and we know that this is likely worldwide. I'm just halfway through reading Rosa Quarry's book, Behind the Green Mask, and she describes this in the U.S. as well. So this is so well planned, to take away all our power and control on a municipal level, and that it comes, from the top down. Of course, to govern well should be the other way around, where it's in the hands of the people, and our councillors and mayor are serving us and working together with us. But it's the other way around now. They are under the auspices of the UN and the WEF and so on.
She was an amazing individual who wrote the book Behind the Green Mask in 2011. And she attended council meetings. She did years of tireless research to pull back the veil of secrecy and uncover the fraud of what's known as Triple P, the public-private partnerships. We'll talk about that more in a moment. But it basically, the book is an amazing read. It's not available easily in bookstores. You can try Amazon or whatever, but there are places you can download the book, at least on your computer screen, print it out for those who wish. But it's an amazing read, and you're able to find videos of her addressing Santa Clara, California, 2011, a town council, and the amazing work that she did. And one of the deputy mayors of that town in 2011 went on YouTube and defied the rest of the councillors and mayor, and it got amazingly heated. But this is one of the giants we stand on their shoulders, as Margaret mentioned, and she is so influential to us as we learn more about the topic. That the closest parallel is Joan of Arc. Like, she was that influential in a movement. She really just exploded onto the scene and laid the groundwork. She's left us now, but she laid the groundwork for us to follow and put together the pieces of the puzzle.
He had a very untimely death. Was it earlier this year or last year?
Oh no, she passed. I believe it was way back.
I don't think so. I think it was much more recently. I believe that's.
I think she died last year.
Yes. I
believe you're right. Yeah, my calendar is off. Yes.
And it doesn't sound under natural circumstances.
Yeah, a very well. Let's just say untimely. But now things have really accelerated. I understand that in 2019. WEF and the United Nations signed the Strategic Partnership Framework to accelerate the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. Does that framework mean that we are all obliged to get in accordance with this agenda?
Well, I think what it means, Marianne, is we put that particular little line into our talk to alert people of the collaboration of these monstrous foreign NGOs, that it's not just all the UN imposing its will upon the people, right? It's UN in collaboration with the World Economic Forum. And the two of them are sort of muscling up to impose their will. And this makes a very formidable foe, a very powerful very moneyed and very deep in the tentacles of every aspect of Canadian society.
But what I think it also means too is that we all have to do our part in trying to fight and talk to our councillors and mayors and show them that this is not the way that we accept. This is not what we bargained for when we thought we had elected them, and not that they were selected, you know, to do this kind of job. And we are heartened, at least to some degree, that people are standing up and speaking to their towns and cities.
Absolutely. We know of another person who's influenced us greatly, Maggie Hope Braun, who actually some years ago took international government as her course of study in university and so on, with the hopes of one day working for the UN. And all of a sudden, as she got into it, she completed her course of study and then sort of went out and on her first assignment, and oh my gosh, what is this? This is terrible. This is not what I signed up for. And she did a 180 and completely divorced herself from any attachment professionally or legally with the UN, and started becoming a whistleblower type. And she went into a smaller township near Peterborough, Ontario, on June 26th of this year, 2023, on the very night that the council was supposed to rubber stamp the strategic plan of that region, the Kawartha region. And she stopped them dead in their tracks because she got them to admit that they had not properly consulted their constituents. Another quick example of this: in East Gwillimbury, Bradford, their neighbors, just to the north of Aurora Newmarket, where we are, a friend of ours, John, had been speaking to council up there multiple times this year. And the council basically said to him, well, you know, we consulted our citizens. We had this survey about this topic on our website for 4 weeks in July. And he said to them, and how many people responded to your survey? And they replied, 27. So he said to them, 65,000 people are governed in your area of Bradford, East Gwillimbury, and Mount surrounding townships. And you're standing here telling me that on the basis of 27 surveys received, you're considering that to be adequate response? Mm-hmm. The next day, in the summer, he went from dawn until into the evening, knocked on how many doors, I don't know, but got 109 face-to-face conversations. And not a single one of them had heard anything about this topic at all. And he took this back to council and said, excuse me, I went to 109 doors and had 109 conversations, and not a single person has any idea what you're talking about. And this is goes back, Marianne, to the importance of filling the gallery, because when we got to the Aurora council meeting, we asked the clerk, she said, come and say hello when you get here, so I know you're here to, you know, make your delegation. And we did. I said, I'm so curious, can you tell us how many people in the public normally show up for what's referred to as a general committee meeting? She looked both ways, like being afraid to be overheard, and said, well, nobody. She said, if it's a really hot button topic, we might get 3 to 5. We put 120 people in there, blew the walls off the back, and kind of fried their brains, because they can do whatever they want if they are not observed. This is why it's so important for people to get involved in their government at the municipal level, go to council meetings, find out what's on the agenda, and show up.
I think that's a very important point. I think that we assume that our elected officials are trustworthy and are working on our behalf. But in fact, across Canada, well, across the world, really, these elected officials have gone rogue.
Absolutely.
And not only gone rogue, but they're actually quite well orchestrated. This is no accident that every town, every city, every municipality is going in the exact same direction.
Yes, and to your point, Joel and I feel that the mayors know what's going on. They have to know what's going on. They signed up for this. They were incentivized for this. Now, we also feel that they have suppressed the information or minimized it to the counselors, because although the counselors have to take responsibility and do their homework, it is there. It's on the WEF, worldeconomicforum.org, you know, what is going on in ICLEI and so on. They can look this up. Mm-hmm. We can, they can, but, you know, as in, you know, some people in every profession don't do all of their job and all of their homework. And it's easier to say, it's just over my head, it's too much or whatever. But they are supposed to be supporting us, representing us, fighting for us, or at the very least, working together. And we feel that this is not happening.
It's a classic case of hear, speak, and see no evil. Or you've heard the expression NIMBY. Well, it's not in my backyard. I just go to work and keep my head down and do my own thing and everything will be fine. Yeah. It's not fine.
No, it's not fine. So essentially at the end of your presentation, you challenge the council to exit these non-binding agreements that they have with these NGOs. What has been the fallout or what has happened? Give us an update on the response to that, because you presented this challenge.
So I think to be accurate and just to state it like it is, Margaret and I had a follow-up meeting with three days after we spoke to council. So this will be September 22. We spoke privately to three of the counselors who at the end of the video of our event had expressed interest in learning more to varying degrees. And we had a 70-minute conversation with them. Basically, we're trying to get them to declare their position, right? Just come out and say it. It's sort of like an old Civil War song, which side are you on? but not being that blunt, perhaps. But we're trying to figure out where they're coming from. And one of the counselors said, since this whole COVID thing started, I have to admit, I've become rather insular and just sort of withdrawn it back into myself. And although we didn't say it because we're polite people, our little meters in our head are going, excuse me, we're out in the community doing our jobs, raising our families, paying our mortgages. We elected you to look after our interests. And for you to sort of cover your eyes and say, I don't know anything, it just doesn't cut it. That's your job. That's what you signed up for. So that's kind of how we feel.
And I think that if this issue were to go to a referendum, and be presented very simply, should your elected officials be representing the people, or should they be in these non-binding agreements with these international organizations? I don't think many Canadians would, in a referendum, say, yes, let's belong to these organizations with unelected officials. I don't think most Canadians have a clue that this is going on.
I was just going to say your last sentence. I don't think most Canadians know what's going on, and that's the importance of getting this kind of information out. But I've got to say there were some very positive parts to our talk that we had in another room in the municipal offices with these three councillors, and some of the things that they opened up to us about were rather meaningful. Like they said, we were the only three on the council, and there would have been seven altogether, including the mayor, who said that people shouldn't have to be forced to take these COVID shots in order to gain employment through the town. And they were overturned because it was 3 versus 4. Right. But it was interesting, their mindset. So in a way, they had some knowledge, not as much as they should have had, but you know the way a lot goes down, whether it's in war, in the justice system, in the military, education, or whatever it is, a lot of the information is compartmentalized on purpose, so that people won't really know unless they dig as deep as they can and then keep going to find out, you know, the truth of what really is going on. Now, one of the counselors said she had been on the World Economic Forum website and she knew about, you know, all the different issues and all the angles that they're trying to take in and superimpose their evil plan, you know, upon us all from every direction. She was quite aware.
Yes, at the end of our talk, she was the lady counselor who said, you know, I was just talking to staff just earlier this week about this, and I don't think it's right. I think Aurora citizens have the right to go about their lives and their daily business without the fear of being surveilled.
Yeah.
So she like dipping her toe in the lake. She knows just a little bit where we've gone, taken a bit of a deep dive, I guess. But it was a confession that they knew, that some of them knew parts of it.
You wanted to say, we were tempted to say, but we didn't. It's too late. We're surveilled from every aspect like that, that we can be already. And it shows, not that we know everything, and far from it, we're always learning so much, and so much information is coming at you. But there was such a level of ignorance of people who should have been out there, you know, fighting for us.
Well, these three, okay, so you have seven counselors. Three sound like they're sympathetic to your cause, and
yes,
four are opposed, or the other four neutral. Give me the rundown of your council in Aurora.
Well, we know, for example, the mayor doesn't feel any affection towards us. We've had run-ins with him before where we spoke up.
We are a known entity to the mayor.
Yes. Well, he's oppositional, but chances are he has been bribed, coerced, or blackmailed in some form. So he's a lost cause. But tell me about the other council. You've got three that sound like they're quite
right.
Learn more. And
right.
Stood their ground on the issue of the mandatory vaccine, which is impressive, but lost that battle. So you have three who are already in your camp, so to speak. What about the other four?
There was one who had come to our door when he was trying to become a counselor for our support. And we, as we always try to do, try to engage in a conversation with them. And we had quite a good conversation. And he was saying, you know, if I'm a counselor, I will be fighting for you. And I really care. So without giving a name or anything, you know, we felt that he wasn't doing this at all. It seems that maybe he was frightened. He was overwhelmed, as we all are. These are really crazy, stressful times. But he sat back and did nothing. So what we're hoping, and the other two, as well as the mayor, we just don't know really where they stand. But what we're hoping in our next talk, we want to invite all seven of them together to have an open dialogue. And we really hope they do come, because the stance that we took was, we're all human beings, we're all, you know, sons, daughters, mothers, fathers, we have children or not, we have spouses or not, but we're all part of the human race. Mm-hmm. And we tried to interact with them from that point of view, that, you know, we have worries and problems, and we want a better world for those who follow, our children and future generations and so on. So that's the point of view that we try to come in with to interact with them.
Yes, we said at the end of our talk, we wish to enter a respectful and meaningful dialogue with the council, etc. We didn't go in there with guns blazing, fingers pointing, accusations flying, notices of liability. All these things are in toolboxes out there. But we went in with the olive branch, let's discuss it. And I'll just share again, as Margaret says, without names, but the counselor Margaret mentioned who came to our door prior to the last municipal election seeking our support, who was one of the ones who said nothing at the end of our meeting. The mayor was silent, and three counselors were silent, and then three spoke, so that's the total of seven. The counselor mayor is a dual role. So the story was that we spoke to a local minister who said, this particular counselor phoned me the morning after you guys spoke at council back in September. And his words were, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. Where did all these people come from? Yeah. That was just a little bit of a story that you don't hear, but no. The person was felt in our confidence enough just to share that, no names, but that was one counselor's take on what just happened.
So it does sound as though some of these counselors haven't a clue.
No.
They've been bamboozled, but now that they've been presented with the facts, they have a choice to make. And somehow, hopefully your community can kind of force them to become public in their decision. Are they representing the people or are they acting on behalf of these international organizations? This is not complicated. It's actually very simple. They have a choice to make. And they should have to make that public to the electorate.
Absolutely. And also, just to finish up the last part, I just wanted to insert that we had hoped that this particular counselor would have contacted us. We left our contact information for everybody. And if he felt more comfortable even on the phone or just one-on-one or whatever it may be, we want to work for the well-being and the best of you know, our town and everybody within it.
Yes.
So, I mean, it has to take both sides to come together.
Yeah, our contact information was not a secret. Canada 411, will unusual surname spelling, will identify us. Yeah, there's three in Canada and there's only one in Aurora. That's probably them. Plus the fact that in the electronic application to delegate to council, all our contact is mm-hmm. their phone, email. It's not a secret. It's if they just click a button, they can let's phone them, let's email them, let's whatever.
But
their silence was deafening, and we're about to roll out the next detailed invitation for all seven of them to sit down with us and methodically go through what we know, have them give their point of view. It's going to be a conversation. It's not going to be a you know, one of those things. It's going to be a discussion among cool, level-headed adults, information gathering. And then we'll know better at the end of that where they're coming from. We love especially to hear from the mayor. And as Margaret said, we're not in each other's good graces right now. And there are reasons for that. And this being just one of them.
Mm-hmm. What's the timeline of this upcoming meeting?
We haven't finalized that yet because we're actually, and we've already been in a meeting with others, with Sheila McFarland. She's really brilliant about this. She tried to go for the mayorship of Guelph. And the actual reason that she was trying to go for this was mostly to glean the information that she could about it, the inner workings, you know, which was brilliant, a really brilliant strategy. So we are actually getting together with her next week. Yes, it is. There's so much going on, it's hard to keep it all straight. But we have a huge wall calendar so that we don't miss anything, but so that we can learn more information and strategize with her, and then we'll go from there. Of course, with the holiday season encroaching upon us, you know, that's a reason for people often to say, well, you know, we're not available now, there's holidays and we have to take months off or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But we'll try to make it work.
Yes, this big follow-up meeting may occur in the first half of January. That remains to be determined. Yeah. But we'll be getting some counsel with Sheila. And I just wanted to mention, Marianne, for your listening audience, just a very simple website where they can learn more about Sheila McFarland and her work, and a very interesting document that she penned. So for those taking notes, the website is simply www.shelaw.ca. Sheila.
Okay, I'll put that in the notes. I'll add that into the notes, because I think that those contacts or those websites for information are critical.
Absolutely.
So what is the support in your community? What, after this presentation, are people contacting you when you bump into people? I don't even know how big Aurora is. How big is Aurora?
We're about 75,000.
About 75,000. What's your sense of the support that you have in Aurora?
Well, it's kind of hard to
Yeah.
gauge. We know that we worked for about 9 or 10 weeks from the moment we got the date secured in July for September 19. We worked hard. We attend a number of different groups and we meet regularly. So we spoke everywhere we went, said, "Hey guys, we're going to be standing up for freedom and our rights, and here's the date, the time, and the place." We did a one-page, two-sided flyer, a little more depth and context about it, handed out hundreds of copies. Kind of like that line from Field of Dreams: "If you build it, they will come." We did, and they did. We're humbled by it, but it was also a great thing. But as far as like citizenry on the seat, like the grocery store, "Oh, I saw your video." A couple of people said that, but it kind of flew under the radar, right? So from the people in our freedom-loving community and different groups that we belong to and different associations, huge numbers of people were encouraging us, and we would get a phone call, a text, or an email. "How's it going? What's the next step? Have you met with them? What did the mayor say? Follow up." All this kind of line of questioning. And we were sort of gathering more intelligence on the best way to approach this. And one of the things we wanted to say about Sheila McFarland is that going back to the 94 municipal primer that came down from the UN, she developed a document in September of 23, just a couple of months ago, and it was her answer. And I'm just going to read you a couple of lines. Here's what she said: "The United Nations is in control of all Canadian governments using public-private partnerships, the three Ps. They look like government, they spend like government, but they're not government." And she said, she called her primer, her reply to their documents, a 22 pager, the POG primer, POGG. "It is our duty to restore peace, order, and good governance," POGG. And it's a beautiful thing, and we're learning it, we're absorbing it. There's every time we open the page, there's always a new fact to absorb and utilize. And to being able to strategize with one of the foundational people who's really done a deep dive into the UN corruption and so on. Most people don't even realize that in many cases, there are, in Aurora as an example, there's six councillors plus a mayor, counted seven councillors. The chief administrative officer, CAO, is appointed. He's not elected. He should be working for the people. He's not. In most cases, in most decisions that affect the lives of the people in Aurora and elsewhere, seven councillors in Aurora, two signatures are required: the mayor and the CAO, and whatever they decide goes. And Margaret made a mention a few minutes ago. Back a few years ago, there was a 400 of the world's major city mayors were gathered together on a gigantic Zoom call and basically given marching orders. Okay, the mayor of Mississauga was one of those. Mississauga is considered a big city, it's separate from Toronto. It's next door, but it is a separate entity. And that person was one of those people on the call. And the person behind the Zoom call giving the directives was some guy named, Bill Gates. That was it, yes. And of course, where Gates goes, the money
Oh,
flows.
yes.
An intentional rhyme there, but that's what happened. And now the mayor of Mississauga is one of Mr. Gates' biggest supporters. Read cash flow again. Okay. No surprise here. You're nodding, but we get this is exactly what's happening. It's all follow the money. So that's sort of where we're
Has
going.
there been any freedom of information request for you to see correspondence or the flow of money to some of these leaders?
That's a really interesting question, Marianne. And on our personal behalf, no, there are maybe some others in the movement who are digging away. This is one of the reasons we're blessed to be able to have conversations, live, Zoom, in person, whatever, with people like Maggie Hope Braun and people like Sheila McFarland are coming up just in a few days next week, to be able to sit down and go over the strategy. Here's what you've done. It was great. You stirred up a hornet's nest. Now let's talk about next steps. Let's invite everyone to sit down, and here is the outline you must offer them. You must have them declare their position and their intention. They're supposed to swear an oath of allegiance to the people. They don't. They swear basically to obey and follow the dictates of the corporation of the town of Aurora, in our particular case where we live. And so it goes across the country. When you dig, you'll find that if you're not for us, you're against us. Yeah. There you go.
I think also, that, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Also the constraints under which regular constituents are allowed to talk to their mayors and council are just incredibly confining. You're given between 3 to 5 to possibly 10 minutes. There are so many constraints of what you can talk about, when you can talk about it. There's also a lawsuit about this, because once again, it's not like they're working for us or with us. It's, you know, all these different things we have to follow, and it's nothing about helping us. It's about them following the structure of the UN and the WEF and doing what they're told and being paid handsomely or whatever under the table they are.
Yeah, the person we know is basically, it's a constitutional procedural lawsuit, complex, multi-layered, long-term, expensive, and all those things. But at the heart of it is the dictates where a council says, you have 3 minutes, you have 5 minutes, you may say this, you may not say that. If anyone shouts yay from the public gallery, I'm closing down this meeting and dismissing everyone. Clear the courtroom kind of thing, you know? So this is what's being officially challenged in an actual lawsuit that is underway as we speak. So there are hopeful signs, but yeah, some FOIA requests would probably, that's a great question.
Really,
that we'll bring
idea.
That up with Sheila.
I think
see if that's another
important and ask specifically for money. I would ask for correspondence with any of these organizations, and I would also ask for any oaths taken. So I would be asking for three things: money, correspondence, and oaths.
Right.
Because to me, these are elected officials. They are they're public servants. And in essence, there appears to be treason.
It is.
They have violated the oath to the people, which is what they're elected to do, is represent us. And they have violated that. That's treason.
Absolutely.
It is, exactly. Actually, we have a page of notes here, just a couple of sentences from Sheila McFarland, drawn from her website, Sheila, SHELAW.ca, we mentioned. And it basically says, at the local level, residents have lost control. And she wrote, this is just very partial, but she said, you elect local representatives to be your direct trustee, your direct public servant, your direct public official. It's a covenant that you make with your elected mayors and councillors who have been asked to serve two masters, the people they're supposed to represent, and the United Nations, and ICLEI, the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives. They are in a high personal liability situation because their signatures are doing a lot of damage. And she talks about, what is a municipality? I'll end with this. If you go to the Municipal Act, municipality is defined 5 different ways, which boil down to 2 definitions. It can be a geographical area, or it can be the municipal corporation, that word again. You have to learn how to read these things. Reading the bylaws is like playing Waldo. Once you find Waldo, you can see it in every document. So it's fascinating reading by someone who's devoted her life to uncovering the truth.
Absolutely. So two things I want to say. In Creston this month, Neil Farstad made a presentation to the councillors in Creston. They were more aggressive in their approach. They have given an ultimatum to their councillors to respond by November 30th and declare, answers to 7 questions that they put forward. And they've given them until November 30th to respond. And the questions are, what oaths have you signed? What agreements have you entered into? You know, and it's very interesting. And I hope that the outcome in Creston is very good because it's precedent setting, but it sounds like the deputation in Creston might serve as a good model for Aurora as a next firm step.
It
Absolutely.
should.
We'll be having a close look at that. And we've heard that it stirred up quite a lot of concern on behalf of government in British Columbia, especially the government of that region. I think it's in the Kootenays. It's part of that area, Creston, BC. And that they're taking this delegation by citizenry, this little miniature uprising, very seriously. It's got them somewhat concerned and off balanced, which is a nice place for them to be in, and it's about
Yes.
time.
I agree. I do think government is worried, because when I spoke with Neil Farstad a couple of days ago, I interviewed him, and he said the mayor had summoned him after this. And
Oh.
our Minister of Health, David Eby, all of a sudden arrived in Creston with four other ministers. This is a tiny town of 5,000 people. So I don't think that's a coincidence. I think they're worried.
You're
And
absolutely right.
they have a strong legal team that is all remaining anonymous behind them. And they're going, very, very targeted approach, very specific, but very legal. And I
Yeah.
think that their approach is a very good one. So hopefully you can have a good chat with Neil and see what they've done. And that might be a superb part two or part three, because your approach has been more conciliatory. You want to work with these counselors. It's very agreeable. But when you have the mayor and the chief officer of the city able to sign off on any initiatives, it doesn't really matter what you do with these counselors, because the control is with the mayor, who's obviously offside, and you've got the chief city officer.
Yeah,
So
the
you
chief
might be
administrative
looking.
officer is an officer of the UN essentially.
Well, he's not even elected. So
No,
he and
he's
the mayor
elected.
can run the show without any of the elected officials having any say. So the sound it sounds to me like there needs to be a more decisive action.
Yes.
But you can chat with Neil and his team about that. But it's very exciting. And the irony is, I think Aurora became quite famous across Canada. I heard so many people talking about the presentation that you made with the council back in September. And I think that if you were to talk with people in Aurora, one thing I'd say is, did you know that Aurora is now quite famous across Canada? In a sense, and you might even want to put some banners up around town and say, we're famous across Canada. You might not know it, but Aurora is famous for this meeting that happened.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, Marianne, because of course Aurora, like most towns, has a Facebook page and a Twitter account and an Instagram and a tele all the grams and all those other part of me we gab all these other things. And I think collectively, in an average month, they get around 7,000 plus views, hits, reads, likes, whatever the term is. And I think, without being too modest, but I believe that our message was seen around the world by well into the seven figures, which kind of dwarfs their presence. So
Oh,
it's like, we
absolutely.
just did you one better.
It was a phenomenal speech that you gave, and I thought you deserved an Academy Award. I certainly
Well, thank you.
That was good.
I yeah,
You
no,
did
M Margaret
deserve
and
it.
I created it, and I was just the one speaking it that
Well,
evening.
and
Thank you for the kind
you
words.
spoke about.
It was brilliant, and I applaud that presentation that you gave. It was punchy, and it was very enlightening. So now, you know what? Should we switch gears and talk about smart cities, 15-minute cities? Because this is the direction we're going. This is a little bit of the end game, right?
Absolutely.
So let's talk about, first of all, tell me, smart cities. Smart means more than smart. What does it stand for?
Basically, one of our freedom groups in Canada, Action for Canada,
Action for
actually
Canada.
created a, if you go to Action for the digit for Action for Canada dot, it's on the back here, I always mess it up, dot com.
.com.
And in the little magnifying glass, you just type in smart cities, IES, smart cities leaflet. You will get something that looks just like this. It's two-sided. On the back are great questions to ask councillor and mayors.
And we took some information from this. Like I say, we put together a lot of information from all sorts of great sources, but it sounds so wonderful, like they're there to protect us. They call them neighborhoods, and you know, where you can bike and everything is so close by. Can you imagine biking with two little kids and your groceries? Like how nonsensical that is. And the thing is, there's so much surveillance, and you get fined if you don't follow, you know, what they want. So it's not as sweet and lovey-dovey as they make it out to be.
See, when people look at this leaflet, it literally says, you're being fooled by the smart 15-minute C40 cities in Europe, they refer to it, narrative. It's touted as a way to save the planet and humanity while keeping you safe and providing you convenience of everything at your fingertips within 15 minutes. Well, what if your aged mother lives an hour outside of town in a long-term care facility, but you've exhausted your credits, so you're not allowed to go outside that boundary, that ringed wire fence or whatever that is there, geoengineering, with things we talk about. So how does that sit with people? The thing is, as we mentioned earlier, they really have no idea that this is creeping down on them. And it's all under the guise of convenience. But in our talk, we wove in some of the actual things that Margaret's going to share.
Here's some really good point form parts of what make up a smart city. So 24/7 surveillance through the Internet of Things inside your home, 5G and LED streetlights with cameras and audio detection outside to monitor, track, record everything. Implementation of exclusion zones and geofencing.
Okay, actually, I'm going to stop you. Let's talk about each one. So surveillance.
Okay,
so surveillance is one of the key features.
Right.
And I'm sure that you are aware of what's going on in Metro London right now. They have cameras on every street, on every driveway, and they're monitoring whether or not you leave your driveway. And if you do, you pay £12. Uh-huh. So that has, unless you have a green car, an electric car. So this is where we're headed. Surveillance is absolutely here. It's coming fast. In some cities, you know, it has arrived. But that surveillance is so unethical.
It is. It's illegal. It's unconstitutional. It's unethical. It's intrusive. It is bearing down on our right to live, breathe, work, worship. Every function of human life,
but that's
it is there to suppress and monitor and control.
But that's not stopping what's happening.
No, no. You're right.
The next point is, you mentioned exclusion zones. Let's talk about the exclusion zones. What exactly do they mean by that?
Well, I think, Marianne, that an exclusion zone, I gave the example of visiting a relative outside your 15-minute circle boundary, border, fence, wall, whatever. It's basically one of the things we said in the talk that we delivered was 15-minute cities at their essence are about controlling everything and everyone. Mm-hmm. And what's meant by that is that you, if you follow the rules, it's sort of like the social credit score that the Chinese government has imposed on their people. We love the people of China, not so much their form of government that oppresses them, right? So the social credit score, as was mentioned briefly in our talk to Aurora Council, is all about behavior and control.
Yes.
If you go to work, keep your mouth shut, which means not posting a Facebook thing, daring to question any edict of government, any policy, any law, any of the things that are happening, that are on the public world stage for all to see. If you keep your head down and your nose clean, you can go to work, you can go to the grocery store, you can go to your little church, you can sort of live your life.
Mm-hmm.
Across that line, and big trouble happens. Yeah. All the controls. So this is what they're talking about, because the car you mentioned about leaving your London driveway, well, if you have a green car, well, that's okay. But otherwise, if you leave and you're not supposed to or allowed to, or you're breaking a rule, you get fined £12.
Yes.
Well, this is oppressive, because the car is run through a series of computer chips. And the people who make the cars are basically in league with these foreign NGOs. So over the time with the technology, it's become very easy to control everyone's cars, just like a governor on a car where you want to stop speeding, put the governor on the car, you can't go more than 90 kilometers foot to the floor. It just, it's used to be capable at 170, now at 90, that's it. They're controlling your behavior. And they'll also control your navigation. If you put in that destination to visit your mom in long-term care an hour away, the car will shut off. It just will not take you there. And when people realize what's happening, one of the fears of people like Margaret and I trying to educate our fellow citizens here in Aurora, Ontario, and Canada is that we're going to be too late. We have to get this under control. We have to let the people know what's happening. Sort of like modern day Paul Revere, if you want, running through the village in Massachusetts saying, the British are coming, grab your muskets, right? So we in our modern day translation, we have to let them know what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This actually reminds me of, we lived in Oxford for a time, and Oxford has a ring road surrounding the whole city. Well, this year, the city decided to impose a fine if you exceed a certain number of departures outside of that zone. So it's almost like you're in a district and you have a limited number of exits out of the district every month. If you exceed that, they send you a fine. So that's already happening in Oxford. Absolutely. And we live there, so we know exactly how it works. They put barriers up. And as your car passes through in or out of that ring road around Oxford, you get fined.
Right.
So you're being monitored. And so that these exclusion zones, I mean, who knows what this means in the future? It may include parks. They may partition off. I've heard that they have a plan that we really should not be allowed into the wild areas. The nature areas, and we're not allowed to visit them because it's only for animals. So the exclusion zone aspect of it is quite eerie.
Right.
Yeah, we can further that by telling you that the exclusion from like a national provincial park or something like that, or getting back to nature, going camping, anything like that, that mm-hmm. they wish to disallow, they can and will. But even more alarming to us at a local level, people in Ontario and Canada listening to our voice will be familiar with Loblaw, which is a giant grocery chain in Canada. And under their banner are a number of other stores, Real Canadian Superstore is one of them. We have one here in Aurora where we live, north of Toronto. And a couple of years ago, you used to be able to go into a grocery store and the sensors would take the two sliding glass doors. And when you're 10 feet away, they would part and you would walk in. Now they have steel piping fencing, heavy duty thick plexiglass bolted in, turnstiles where you have to go, an electronic bar which you can push aside, but in the future if it wishes to bar your entry, it will be locked and you cannot push it aside. This is access to your groceries, your food for your family. They have spent tens of thousands of dollars at this one local store as an example. Others are beginning to follow, to restrict your access to the necessities of life. And it's there for us who can see, and everyone else completely missing the point.
Remarkable. Okay, you know, Margaret, go ahead with the third point.
Sure, so it says ability to control behavior through military directed energy technologies. And I think we've experienced some of this at rallies in Toronto. We used to go every Saturday to the rallies in Toronto, and people often felt sick afterwards. And it could be these, you know, directed energy weapons, which they can ramp up, and we know what's happened in California, in Hawaii, and in other places. It's and they've done this all over the world. It's very evil. Mm-hmm. So that's another one.
So controlling behavior, I think there's so many layers to that as well.
Yeah,
you can control behavior through monitoring your social media and then dictating, like the trucker's convoy, whether or not you have access to your bank account because you attended a rally or you supported a rally.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many, well, all we have to do is look at China, really.
Right.
Control people's behavior.
Yeah, this is
Exactly.
exactly why we put the line in about Klaus Schwab with the World Economic Forum, and under his directive, because Justin Trudeau is one of his prize pupils of Young Global Leaders Program, along with the UK and France and New Zealand and other members of the Commonwealth and other countries as well. We wanted to make the connection to see, to tell people that this person, who some people are now figuring out is part of the, a major part and the founding father of the World Economic Forum, is actually pulling their puppet strings. You will own nothing and be happy. And we have penetrated more than 50% of Trudeau's cabinet. That would be Canada, people. So we're just, that's why we put the emphasis on it during the speech, to make sure, force people to connect that, oh, really? I didn't know that. Now you know.
Pretty nefarious.
Absolutely. And yeah,
Then
go ahead.
the next point here is property ownership, car,
Yeah.
automotive car ownership. Do you want to expand on that a little?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we've already seen with the electric cars what a failure they are. And in fact, factories have closed up. I mean, there's so much that's wrong with electric cars, from them being able to control, and actually they take more energy than your regular, gasoline car. And how, the cobalt and what's used for putting together the batteries is usually from slave labor children in third world countries.
Belgian Congo is one great example of the lithium batteries and the cobalt. Absolutely.
And there are not enough charging stations. I mean, even in the southern United States, we've heard from friends, I mean, where the weather is very warm, that people have to line up for hours to get their cars to go. So it's just a total failed experiment. But I mean, these electric cars, the average person could not afford them. So, everything from what they're doing to the greening of our homes to electric cars, it's making living in even a small home or owning a car just about impossible for the average person. And that's their goal.
We read a story that one of the major car manufacturers on the planet, which has plants overseas and in the US and in Canada, the person bought an electric car, and 20 months later the battery just completely died. You have to get a new one. 50,000 Canadian dollars for the battery. Now, if
No,
that's not holding someone to ransom, I
the
don't know
electric
what
cars,
is.
yeah, there's no justification for these electric cars from an environmental standpoint, the
Oh.
energy utilized to build one, and getting everyone reliant on the power grid puts everyone in a
Right.
very vulnerable position.
Absolutely.
Yes. But how about property ownership? Property ownership, we know that WEF, they talk a lot about you own nothing and be happy, but what do you think this means? Does it mean that really the powers that be do not want to see us owning our home?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be so expensive for most of us to do so, because all of these new issues, they're telling us we have to get our home up to standard by greening them, with all the arbitrary, nonsensical rules to follow. Well, most people cannot follow those. We just can't afford them at all. So they want to cram us into apartments, with very little space.
Yeah, we had an example. We spoke at a freedom rally in Toronto in May of 2023, and the other speaker on the ticket basically said, have a look down the block. They're just putting shovel in the ground to build a 600 unit condominium building at this, at the big empty hole down the street. And he had the plans, and he said the 600 condominium units, and the first floor will be 40 businesses, including a full size grocery store, plus 40 other businesses. 600 condo owners, 300 parking spaces. So that's for half the condo owners, half a space average each, which doesn't mathematically compute, and zero parking spots for the people who want to go to the big grocery store and all the other merchants on the ground level. Geez, how are their customers going to get there? Oh, they're going to walk or take their bike. Downtown Toronto, bicycling in February through the rutted streetcar track streets. Good luck. Hope you make it okay.
Very, very alarming. Okay, the next point is digital passports. I'm running off the list that you used when you presented. You put together a very good list outlining the 15-minute city. Digital passports, do you want to comment on that?
Sure, digital passports are being used to control populations around the world. And the foundation of the digital passport is twofold, Marianne. One thing is to force vaccine compliance on the world's population. The World Health Organization is in the final stages right now of trying to impose their will on virtually every country on the planet through a pandemic treaty and changes to what's referred to as the International Health Regulations. And in the constitution of the World Health Organization, just to keep it close, every country has the right to say, no, sorry, we're not doing this. We're cutting our ties. We're leaving the World Health Organization agreement between country X and the WHO. The problem is that it requires a letter signed by the president or prime minister or equivalent of the country in question or their number one health official. Think Theresa Tam in Canada, for example. Well, she sits on the board of directors of the World Health Organization, as does Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland sit on the major council behind the World Economic Forum. So it's not a conspiracy theory to say that they are conflicted. Is their duty to Canada or their duty to this foreign master? Mm-hmm. We need to know that. The other thing is you talk quickly about there's a lot of things going on in Canada about health of the people and the different provinces. Health is a provincial jurisdiction. However, the kicker is that the money for the province to run their health program for their citizens comes from the federal government in the form of an annual allowance of X hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, whatever. So the latest ploy of the Canadian federal government is we, the federal government of Canada, who happens to wear liberal red at the moment, we will give you province of, let's say Alberta, for example, we will give you the money to fund your healthcare program for 24-25 fiscal year, as long as you agree to have us implement digital identification into your province. That's the swap, that's the deal. If you say no, no health money to implement your programs.
So it's
classic Mexican standoff.
Blackmail.
Yes, that's the word.
That clearly is blackmail. So the digital passports are, and we've seen those, they really rolled them out in a sense during the COVID vaccine era. Right. Show your papers to enter public places, restaurants, movie theaters. So we've already had that. In a sense, people have happily adopted the digital passport, but I think it's going to become a lot more sophisticated.
Well, it is. It goes back to the barriers at the local Real Canadian Superstore in Aurora, Loblaw's corporate overlord. They were built to control access to food so that in 24, 5, or 6, if the law of the land imposed by foreign NGOs is that you must have a digital passport to show on your smartphone to enter the premises and buy food to feed your family, you have it, you enter, you buy, you eat. You don't, be gone with you.
Yes.
Your tough luck. That's pretty draconian.
It's so, and this is required in China, and we look at China and go, oh my gosh, that's horrible. But it's coming to Canada.
Absolutely. It,
spoiler alert, it's already here.
No, I think you're right. I think it is here. But the way that they're rolling this out in Canada is more subtle. Mm-hmm. And I think they're just hoping that Canadians are not paying attention.
Well, the good thing is, I must say, you could call it a silver lining, and it's not as fast as we would hope, but people are waking up. And we're seeing this because of, you know, many other of these tentacles that are laid out at the same time, whether it's, you know, cutting our access to natural health products and so on. Mm-hmm. People at least 75% of Canadians want access, including our MPs, many of them. So when their offices are absolutely flooded with the postcards that we're sending out, some of them have gotten up in Parliament and said, yes, we would like to have our health products, access to our health products. So there is an awakening, and mm-hmm. we hope it's going to be explosive.
I hope it's fast enough. Now, the next item with the 15-minute cities is the digital currency. Would you like to comment on that?
Wow. Digital currency is only everything. You control the money, you control the people. This example is never more clearly set than in February of 2022, where people who attended the Ottawa Truckers Convoy, we came in peace, we wished to speak to the Prime Minister, he would have nothing to do with it, he literally hid himself in his home or fled the country or both. And it's basically the digital passport, the digital currency. It's they, if you made, we know people who made a $10 donation on a major fundraising site, I think it was a GoFundMe perhaps, mm-hmm. who made to the Freedom Convoy, made a contribution for food, water, fuel, the necessities of life. And that basically the banks were required to turn over identifying information, bank accounts, credit cards, you know, name, address, phone number, all that sort of stuff, email, to the government, who tracked them down and froze their bank accounts. That's why the comment was in the talk we gave, because it was absolutely, undeniably, factually true.
Yes.
We worked very hard to make sure we just weren't spouting rhetoric. Everything we said pretty well can be sourced and proven to be true. So if they can turn off your money, you can't buy food, you can't buy fuel, and you can't pay your rent or mortgage. That's sustainable for a week or two, after which a lot of people are in a world of trouble.
Yes, but this is also why we encourage people with little cards and $20 bills that look very much like imitation $20 bills, the importance of using cash. And people are open to this. And, you know, if there's a long lineup, you only have a few seconds to talk. But it has a website on it. And people seem to be interested in why is it that we take time to, you know, bring this up and explain it to them. So once again, there is an opening.
Yeah, it's very catchy. It actually started in the UK. And at a glance from a few feet away on a desk or a tabletop, it looks real. And you take a step forward, and oh, because it's folded over. And
you know what? Can you share with me where people can get their hands on that?
Yes, we will send you an email with a link to that website.
Because that is brilliant. I did see that initiative in the UK, and I didn't know it had already happened here in Canada. Is it Cash is Freedom or something like that?
Well, there are a couple of different ones. Basically, the website on the front next to the image of the 20 and the Queen is keepcashalive.com.
Keepcashalive.com. That is a brilliant, what I call, guerrilla marketing campaign. You leave those in Starbucks. You leave these in all those places where people are hanging out. And it's brilliant because, of course, you're going to pick up a 20 and they look real. But I agree with you. Cash is imperative.
It is imperative.
Stymies this trend towards digital currency. And I'm terrified with the digital currency because, as Karstad said, he's the head of the Bank of International Settlements. Mm. He's come right out and has said, we want digital currency because we want central control of everyone's money and spending. We want complete and utter surveillance, how they spend their money, where they spend their money, and the ability to turn it off. Well, this is the Chinese model.
It is.
And to add brilliance to this guerrilla marketing piece, on the back, there's a whole, one of the panels is about central bank digital currency, and that's under stopworldcontrol.com with a suffix that you can go to that section of the website. And well, there's this digital ID on the other panel. So it's a 3-in-1 teaching tool. And we give it to cashiers. We pay cash almost every time, wherever we can. And frequently in major grocery retail stores, it's young people manning the cash register. And God bless them, but they're on their little cell phones and they're on their Facebooks and they're on their this and that. And they just, this is all sort of flying over their radar, as you wish. And it's like, oh my God, really? I said, here's the thing. Have a look at this later tonight when you get home. Check the website. You got to line up now. Don't take time. Don't get in trouble with your boss. Yeah. But have a look at this later. It's really important that you educate
really
yourself
important.
On what's going on.
I agree
on.
With you. We have such power. Well, that is a wonderful piece to circulate. I think it's brilliant. You could put them on windshields in parking lots. You can. It's so easy to distribute a fake 20. You could line them, you know, drop them on a walk in a park and just let people pick them up. It's brilliant. But I think the power of cash is incredible. And what I've done now is I often will go into a business and ask, do you take cash? And if they don't, I say, I'm so sorry. I'd love to do my business here. But because you don't take cash, I won't. And this is why. You know, and it's very powerful because I think it's important to explain to the merchants that are not taking it why you're not giving them your business.
Yes.
I think it's one of the most effective maneuvers to block central bank digital currency is to keep using the cash.
Yeah. We have heard stories of Walmarts in Canada as an example who, you know, they're open till 10 at night. So from 7 o'clock till 10, when it's a little bit quieter, they only have automated checkouts. There are no cashiers. Well, guess what? It's only credit card. They're not accepting cash. Well, the people rose up and said to Walmart, okay, listen to us carefully. If you're going to be this way, we're going to go elsewhere. And in many cases, within 24 hours, all of a sudden, there were 4 cashiers on until 10 p.m. close to accommodate people who wish to use cash. How about that?
Yeah, yes. we have so much more power than we give ourselves credit.
Yes.
There's 8 million of us.
Right.
And we need to flex our muscles a little. Our collective action does make a difference.
Yeah. And Monica Smith's, wonderful freedom advocate from Australia, was also promoting the same thing. She has little tiny cards as well. And it's about using cash, keep cash alive. So we put this kind of thing, whether it's little cards or other freedom kind of brochures, in a public washroom or in a baby change table or at a bank machine or, you know, even on a shelf of a grocery store and so on. You know, you know some of them will be thrown out, but the ones that aren't can be, you know, very educating to people. So.
We walk into grocery stores during the pandemic lockdown restrictions without a face mask. And people look up from the aisles and said, oh, you're not wearing your mask. How did you get in? And we said, we walked in, just like you did. But you have to wear a mask. Well, actually, no, we don't. There's this provincial government law in effect. Here's a copy. Would you like a copy? It says that we're right to not wear a mask and to breathe freely is protected under provincial law. And there's a whole other story behind that. But people look at us in amazement, and some of them rip it right off their face, and we get into the most interesting conversations about freedom.
The best feeling ever to see that.
You two are a real pair. I love it. You're kind of co-conspirators. So let's jump to the next item, universal basic income, UBI. Tell me what your thoughts are on UBI.
Oh, boy. Already it's so disheartening to see people who, for whatever reason, and we even have some family members, can't work. For many reasons, and the way the most vulnerable in our society are treated is terrible. Your heart breaks, and this will only be greatly exacerbated under this universal basic income, where, you know, for example, creativity and being industrious will not be honored or rewarded at all. They want everybody at the same low level. So it's extremely scary, proposition to think that this is what the direction that they're driving in.
Yeah, it's basically a control mechanism. And it says your primary source of income in the future will be doled out to you on the last business day of the month by direct deposit to your bank account by your municipal, by your provincial or federal government, and it's a control mechanism. To qualify for that monthly deposit, you must toe the corporate company Canadian policy line. And if anything we see, and they see, it's like the Christmas song, we know what you've been thinking, we that one. They watch you 24/7. They know even what you're thinking with this artificial intelligence. There are no secrets anywhere, let alone whispers to a friend on Facebook that are intercepted. It basically says if you are causing any trouble, we're going to cut off this monthly income. And then you're back to the how do I buy groceries? How do I pay my mortgage? How do I pay the Enbridge gas bill that just came in the mail today?
Universal
Yikes.
basic income scares me on so many fronts, but I
Yes.
do believe it's coming. It's passed the second reading in the Senate in Canada already. So you know that they are going to roll it out. And my fear is that they will combine universal basic income with Canada pension,
Oh, yes. Yeah.
old age pension. I think a lot of these things will be rolled into one.
Oh,
The
yes.
universal basic income will become the norm or become the only entity, but of course it's going to be tied to central bank digital currency. So it's a very,
Nefarious.
I'm nervous about UBI
Yeah,
because that
and
to me is
vaccination.
socialism on steroids.
And one of the other things, we're talking about UBI, Universal Basic Income, Marianne, but one of the other things, going back to the passports, we have the situation going back quickly to the World Health Organization, where Tedros, the Director General, is they're doing a massive power grab of all the countries on Earth to control the people, the countries, the governments, and the health system, so that in May of 2024, if their agenda passes unencumbered by the citizens of the world, Tedros, one man on the planet of 8 billion, will be able to declare a pandemic with no justification, no science, no evidence, just because he says so. And he will control the Canadian government because it is binding under international law. People, you can look this up. And then what happens is if you refuse to be vaccinated as per the dictates to protect you against this World Health Organization suddenly declared pandemic, they are will basically order police and military in Canada to force the issue with you on a door-to-door basis. And if police and military in Canada say, I'm sorry, we're not doing that to our people. Then the UN troops come in internationally and they go door to door with medical personnel, side by side with armed personnel. This is a draconian nightmare, but it's actually what will happen if we sit by and watch this. We must not do that.
It's so Orwellian. And along with that, your comments there, one of the last points are the climate lockdowns that are associated with these smart cities. The climate lockdowns are the same. They can declare a lockdown because we have a climate crisis based
Which
on no
nothing,
science.
nothing, right? And that's coming. I mean, that's in my mind, that's the next plan, even though so many scientists, thousands have spoken against how fraudulent that is. Of course, you don't hear their voices on mainstream at all. They've been totally suppressed. But this whole, carbon dioxide, which of course plants need, like they must have all missed their science classes, right?
Oh, yeah. I always ask people when they go on about carbon dioxide, I say, listen, what percent of the atmosphere is carbon dioxide? People haven't a clue. They guess, 10, 15%. It's 0.04% of the atmosphere is carbon dioxide. Who cares what we which way we push it? It's inconsequential. And
It's interesting, Marianne, because some of the people doing 15-minute city delegations in Canada and elsewhere are taking some of their precious 5 minutes to tell mayors and councillors about the climate change fraud and the 0.4% that you just mentioned, and the fact that life on Earth is dependent upon this. And again, it's exposing the fraud and so much to cover in 300 seconds. My who knew? But they're actually using this, some of that 5 minutes, to speak to this.
Yes.
This climate change is completely fraudulent. Without this, there is no life on Earth. It's totally contradictory. It's like grade four science. It's like you think of the tobacco industry, you know, back in the 50s and 60s when we were growing up. Television commercial, your doctor prefers Camels. Really? Okay, gosh, tobacco science. There's a reason it's called that, and so on. And it's just been grown up into the climate change fraud.
Well, so what keeps you both awake at night?
Well, I think that we have to try our very best to make this world a better place for our children and the future of humanity, because, you know, you get one chance of this life, who knows what the next iteration will be, right? Mm-hmm. But while we're here, you know, we want to do our very best to improve the situation, which seems pretty grim at times, but by awakening people, by writing letters, by speaking, by doing everything we can to inform people, you know, to, for example, use cash or just say no, not take shots, if that's what they want. Use their freedom, you know, do your own research skills. Don't do what's been happening very insidiously over these many decades is the indoctrination. You know, you're not really aware of it until, oh my gosh, you become an observer and see what they've done to us, right? So we just have to keep, you know, trying to teach ourselves, learn the best, and be the best advocates. And we get dozens of phone calls of people, whether it's to do with 15-minute cities or, you know, any other of the issues that we're working on to try to help them. And because people feel very desperate, you know, what direction. Yeah.
Yeah. Joel, what keeps you awake at night?
Well, a number of things, but to keep the segment very short, Marianne, it's literally the brain fires up unattended and it says, did we return that phone call? Did we answer that email? Did we mark it unread to talk about over coffee in the morning while we're doing whatever around the house, organizing or planning the day? And it's a little bit like the story of the starfish and the old man and the little boy on the beach. For those who haven't heard it, there was a great big storm, maybe in Texas, in the miles of beaches. And an old man is walking along and he comes upon a young boy, and there's millions of starfish that have washed up on the beach due to the storm. And the old man watches the little boy bend down and pick up a starfish and fling him back into the ocean. And after watching him do this for a number of times, he says, little boy, what are you doing? He says, I'm throwing the starfish back in the ocean. But why? Well, they'll die if I don't. The old man says, but you're just one little boy. How could you possibly make a difference? Without a word, the little boy stooped down, picked up another starfish and hurled him into the ocean, and looked up at the old man and said, I made a difference to that one.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we are. And if we're allowed just to veer off just into a different tangent for a moment, one of the things about controlling populations, and we talked about vaccines and we talked about vaccine passports and vaccine mandates, all too well known to the populations of Canada, the US in the last several years, in the age of COVID, so it doesn't need any other explanation. Many people in Canada and US and around the world lost their employment and their livelihood because they refused to take a COVID shot. We don't use the word vaccine. World Health Organization in 2018 changed the official legal definition of the word vaccine to allow the COVID shot yet to be born and created and disseminated to fit under their vaccine definition. They changed the meaning of the word. Anyway, but basically, Margaret and I are part of an organization known as Vaccine Choice Canada. And we stand since 1982, we're 41 years young. It's a federal registered nonprofit educational society dedicated to supporting the right of people to choose what goes into the body of themselves, their family, and their dependent children. Bodily sovereignty, the right to freedom, it's all supported by the Nuremberg Code Against Medical Experimentation, the Helsinki Accord. Health Canada issued a statement saying that vaccines cannot, in 96, that vaccines cannot be made mandatory in Canada because of the Canadian Constitution. Yet, school boards and health units across the country have, in addition to being saying safe and effective, preaching that for 100 years, they are telling families that your child must be vaccinated against this, that, and the other to attend school. That is a blatant lie and untruth. Only two or three areas in Canada, New Brunswick, Ontario, and I think Northwest, Nunavut, perhaps.
No. I think it's one of the Maritime provinces.
Yeah,
there are only three.
Yeah, exactly. Actually have that you must have a childhood shot to enter school. And in each of these provinces, there are exemptions. The exemptions were brought into force in Ontario by our Birthright organization in 82 when Vaccine Choice Canada was founded. We could speak to the Ontario Health Ministry at the boardroom table back then, something you could never do today. And we spent 2 years educating them, and we got the exemptions in place. They're still in place. They're under great duress and challenge, but they still stand firm under the law. And we're making aware of their people's right to choice. That's why we're called VaccineChoiceCanada.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you too, Joel and Margaret Sussman, you too are an inspiration. And you're delightful Canadians, and I'm so grateful for the work that you've done thus far. And I know you're both going to continue on. I can tell you're fired up and energized. So I encourage you on in the battle, and thank you so much for the work that you've done. And thank you for your time today, bringing us up to speed on the aftermath of that presentation in Aurora with your town council. And let's stay in touch. If there's anything significant that occurs, please reach out to me and we'll do a follow-up.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity, and great thanks to you for all the people that you bring on, you know, to educate others. So thank you very much.
Yes, you appeared on our National Vaccine Choice Canada Zoom calls back in May of this year and educated people a great deal about money and situations and banking and what's going on, and exposing the truth, which we all must do. So we extend
that's my other hat that I wear as a former broker, stockbroker. I try to advise people on money because I think people are really stuck. They're bewildered. They're not hearing authentic sort of, they're not getting good guidance from their stockbrokers or their investment advisors. So no, I try to help people on that front too, but that's a completely different, a different type of work I do, but so important as well. So maybe I can give an update to Vaccine Choice Canada, because I think I've done two presentations.
Yes, you have.
Yeah. So we might be due for another one. So well, lovely to meet you both, and it's delightful, and thank you so much for your time.
It's been great, Marianne. Thank you very much.
So the final message to the people watching this is stand firm, stand in your truth, and get involved. Mm-hmm. Don't be a bystander. Life is now. Your future is in your own hands.
Oh, that's a good close. Very good words there. Thank you, Joel. Okay, we'll talk again.
Okay.
Thank you, Marianne. All the best. Okay. Bye for now.
Bye.